I know just about this much about legal matters and courts. However, I do feel it's an honor to introduce Andy Orton because of the monumental task he has set for himself. If we think about it for a moment, when the conquerors arrived on the shores of the Americas, they brought laws with them. They were laws that were used to maintain order in Europe. There were laws over here, too, that maintained order here. And the basis of those laws was different. In Europe, particularly in England, those laws were based on private property and a certain idea of the relationship between human beings and nature. It's very different over here. Very different idea of property and the relationship with nature. But it was not only that. Not only that the Europeans brought their own laws, not the laws that were prevalent here that had survived centuries of experiment, social experiment. There was another thing too, and that is that the Europeans came here as conquerors. And when the First Nations of all over the continent made so-called treaties with the conquerors, it was obvious that the power relationships were very different. And so the treaties really were not meant for the native peoples to overcome or to get back what they had lost. It was just to sort of try and safeguard whatever little was left. And so when you put those two things together, you add to that the courts that are also white men's courts, it becomes almost impossible to think that a native person could ever win on anything. And that's why what Andy's doing seems incredibly difficult. And it requires the task of an experienced and distinguished lawyer to do that. And just so you get an idea what that distinction is, I'll read a little bit here about Andy's CV. He's a very modest man, so he probably wouldn't tell you anything about it himself. And his son's here to heckle him, so. So Andy is he's a solicitor, barrister, based in Hamilton. And he's a member of the Law Society of Canada. He holds degrees not only in law, the British-based law, but also Quebec law, which is different. He's advised and assisted Aboriginal peoples in a number of Canadian provinces and territories on a wide range of human rights, environmental, constitutional, and international law matters. And his clients have included the Grand Council of the Crees in Quebec, National Chiefs of the Assembly of First Nations, and the estate and family of the late Dudley and George, who, as you know, was shot by the OPP. He's led and participated in international human rights and electoral commissions for the International Council of Jurists, Amnesty International, and the Canadian Bar Association, and has also appeared before domestic courts and international human rights tribunals and forums. He initiated and was project director from 1995 to 2000 of the Constitutional Litigation and Legal Development Project in South Africa, which is where he came from, which is an award-winning CEDA-funded project. He has held research and faculty appointments at McGill University and from 87 through 96. He did that. He's also been an author and contributed to numerous texts and articles in the fields of Aboriginal and human rights, administrative law, and health law. So as you can see, we're talking about a very distinguished jurist.
George, for that embarrassing introduction. It's wonderful to have so many people out on a cold evening, cold Saturday evening, on Human Rights Day. And as I walked in here and realized how many of the people here that I actually know, excluding my son and my niece. There's obvious reasons that I know them. What impressed me as soon as I came in was that this evening is full of connections. And I think in the end that's what human rights activity and Amnesty International is about, is all of the interconnectedness that that we all have. And I've got a few personal observations in regard to this evening's business, as it were, relating to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and Amnesty International itself. I owe a kind of a personal debt of gratitude to Amnesty, and I won't go into the details. But George mentioned that I'm from South Africa, and I and others who were involved there in the anti-apartheid struggle were some of the recipients of letters and postcards of support and even visits of support, and letters, more importantly, to the apartheid government that protested some of the things that were being done to anti-apartheid human rights workers in the darkest eras of the empire of the apartheid era. And Amnesty chapters to us at that point in time were these beacons, these candle flames that were so terribly far and inaccessibly away over there in Canada and in England and in Denmark, but represented such an enormous amount of hope wherever those postcards and those letters went. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which we meet here tonight to mark and celebrate, is really just the beginning of the formal codification of the rights of humankind. And I think that really is something to celebrate, because it's a living and growing tree. And in the matter of show and tell, I've brought a volume which is labeled the International Human Rights Instruments, and by a very renowned American international human rights lawyer, Richard Lilich. And the Universal Declaration is just the first instrument in this many hundred-page book. And the development of international human rights law continues to this day. And it's a work in progress, and it will never be complete. Another personal connection was that shortly before we fled South Africa in 1976, on June the 17th, there was a very famous demonstration by young black high school students and elementary students in Soweto, who grew tired of the pace of change in apartheid South Africa and decided to march after having been ignored on a school strike that they had maintained already for a number of years, and decided to march from where they lived in Soweto to Johannesburg. And before they even reached the boundaries of Soweto, 2,000 of them were mown down in a bloody couple of hours by the South African police. And there was a remarkable photograph that appeared on the front page of a Johannesburg newspaper and subsequently the international papers, of young students aged 9 and 12 and 13 and 15 walking towards a wall of heavily armed police officers, holding aloft little manila-covered, coloured, brown books the size of passports. They were the United Nations popular copies of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And those little books had no reach and no impact and no connection with the legal system in South Africa. But the content of those books resided in the minds and hearts and the very being of those high school students, and inspired in them to demand recognition of their dignity and of their humanity in what was ultimately, just minutes later, the face of gun power that took hundreds of their lives. Ipawash Provincial Park is just one corner of a piece of land on the shores of Lake Huron in Ontario, about 75 kilometers west of London.
When Treaty 27 was signed between the Chippewa and the British Crown in 1827, this land was guaranteed as Indian Reserve land in protection, in return for the promise of the protection of the Crown and what the Crown recorded as the surrender of over 2 million acres of indigenous land. In 1927, some 60 acres of those 2,000 acres, 0.1% of the Indians' traditional land, were allegedly sold to the government of Ontario for a provincial park, Hipawash Park. The park contained a sacred burial ground, which was then almost immediately desecrated and destroyed when the park was built. By way of editorial note, as the Hipawash inquiry, which is now underway, proceeded, what governments had maintained for decades afterwards, which has local echoes, which I'll go into in a moment, that there was no burial ground on those lands, have been laid to rest. And one of the photographs that has become available in the context of that inquiry was taken in the 1950s by a government, Ministry of Natural Resources official, which is a skeleton emerging on the sandy beachfront area of Hipawash Park. It was and it remained very well known through the years as they continued that that was a burial ground, but when it became convenient to deny it, that's exactly what happened. In 1942, the rest of that 2,000-acre reserve was taken from the Chippewas by the federal government of Canada to create a military base for World War II. The Chippewas who lived there were resettled on the backs of trucks with almost no notice to a neighboring reserve. The band was given a cabinet order stating that their land would be returned to them, quote, at the end of World War II hostilities. However, more than 50 years later, the land had still not been returned. Dudley George was one of the 30 or so unarmed elders, men, women, and children, who peacefully occupied the provincial park on September the 4th, 1995, after the park had closed to the public for the season. This occupation followed the occupation just a couple of months before of the military base, which constituted the larger part of the whole reserve. That occupation had been led by World War II veteran Clifford George, who had fought right through World War II in Europe. The occupiers did so to protest the destruction of their burial ground to create the provincial park, and for 50 years of delay in returning it to them and returning these lands that were confiscated for a military base. The response of the newly elected government of Ontario, the Mike Harris government, was immediate and brutal. The Ontario Provincial Police, the OPP, were ordered or encouraged to deploy tactical units, snipers, and riot squads to confront, and the word confront is a quotation mark, Indians in the park, without any regard to the legitimacy of their grievances or the danger to life. It now appears that one or more senior cabinet officials in the Ontario government stated in the presence of an inspector of the OPP that it was the government's wish in the hours before the shooting for the police to get the fucking Indians out of the park. And I apologize for using that word, particularly in a church. But I think that reporting the real content of that phrase, the laden content of a cabinet minister or a premier of this province referring to Indigenous people as fucking Indians in the legislature, in the presence of the Ontario Provincial Police, is worth repeating. This was a government that had just been elected, among other things, on a platform of no special rights for Indians, notwithstanding that by virtue of their unique legal and historical status in Canada, the Constitution itself has a whole part that recognizes and affirms special Aboriginal and treaty rights, and that the Supreme Court of Canada, in many rulings prior to the date in which that government got elected on that odious platform, had upheld those special rights in numerous rulings. First, the OPP massed 200 armed officers near the park and sealed off the roads leading to the park. Fearing a police attack or a siege, the demonstrators pushed a dumpster up against the park gates. Late in the day on September 6th, a force of about 50 riot officers with batons, helmets, and shields and snipers with laser-guided machine guns advanced on the park. They remained there for some time, beating their metal batons on their shields, advancing and retreating from the park fence, and apparently yelling racial taunts at the demonstrators. A number of policemen threatened Dudley George with the words that we're going to get you, and you'll be first. There were no longer any journalists in the vicinity as the evening went on, and the police had turned off all of the lighting in the area, as if they were preparing for a siege. Bernard George, a Kettle Point band counselor who was not part of the demonstration but who had witnessed the police build-up in the area, feared for the safety of the demonstrators and decided to try to intervene between the two sides to prevent bloodshed. He went to the demonstrators to suggest that the women and children be evacuated and then walked faithfully down the access road towards the police, hoping to convince them to back off. He hadn't got further than a few meters out of the park when the police attacked Bernard George, approximately 10 officers surrounding him as he was taken down to the ground. While he yelled, "I give up," the police beat him repeatedly with batons and kicked him with their boots, and he lost consciousness. Seeing this Rodney King-style beating of one of their local officials, some of the demonstrators immediately leapt over the fence and out of the park to try and rescue Bernard George. But they too were beaten with batons. Some of the Indians in the park began to throw stones and other objects at the police, but the attack on Bernard George and the others continued. By this time, the demonstrators feared for Bernard George's life, and so a 14-year-old demonstrator was instructed by an elder to drive a school bus towards the police to divide them up or drive them away. Pushing the dumpster aside with the bus and pushing the gate open with the bus as well, the young man did as the elder had told him, and was followed by another teenager in a car. At this time, the police began firing at the bus and the car, and then at the demonstrators themselves. Dudley George was shot by an OPP sniper, Sergeant Kenneth Dean, with a laser-guided semi-automatic weapon. He was first shot in the leg, and as he began fleeing towards the park, and when he spun round, was shot in the chest. The young driver of the bus and one of the other demonstrators were also shot. The demonstrators expected that they would receive immediate assistance or an ambulance, but none arrived. Dudley's cousin went off to telephone for one, but was arrested at the payphone before she could do so. Dudley's brother and sister then drove him in a car with one burst tire to the nearest hospital more than 25 miles away in Strathroy. On arrival at the hospital, Pierre and Cully George and the teenager who had driven the car were arrested and dragged away before they could ensure that Dudley was removed from the car and received medical treatment. They only learned later in their jail cells that Dudley had died on admission to the emergency ward. Miraculously, there were no other fatalities. Bernard George's injuries were extremely serious, requiring urgent medical attention and surgery over the months that followed. The physician that attended to him that night has testified that he had more than 25 severe bruises consistent with blows from batons or boots on his back, his groin, and his head. He also suffered a serious laceration on his head and other bruises on his arms and legs. The OPP issued press statements immediately after the shooting at about 1 a.m. on the following morning, stating that the Indians had fired on the police and that the police had returned fire. We've since learned from the incident commander, Inspector Carson, at the inquiry, that the OPP knew it that the Special Investigations Unit would open an investigation as soon as daylight arrived the following morning and put a clamp down on OPP statements. And they decided to seize the moment to get their side of the story out before that happened. And as it turns out, it was a lie. This statement about the Indians having fired on the police and that the police had returned fire was repeated by the Ontario government. The Ontario Premier stated repeatedly that the government had had to act to remove the illegal demonstrators. In response to an inquiry by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial summary or arbitrary executions in Geneva, the Canadian federal government also repeated this lie about Indians having fired on the police. The truth is, as an Ontario judge subsequently ruled, and the commissioner of the OPP admitted to the inquiry recently, these were unarmed native men, women, and children, defending a sacred burial ground, being beaten and shot in the dark by paramilitary police in Canada in 1995. OPP transcripts from the night Dudley was killed have since revealed that the OPP knew at the time that the protesters were unarmed and possessed nothing more than sticks. After the killing, a number of other key points have also become apparent. Federal government documents confirmed all along the natives were right about the status of the land as a burial ground. The OPP had deployed armored vehicles and military equipment for use against the demonstrators, although these were not, in the end, used. Some police officers had consumed large quantities of alcohol at the scene. A conservative member of the provincial legislature, Marcel Bourbien, was present in the OPP command post in the hours before the killing, urging the OPP and the provincial premier to use force against the demonstrators. The government sought and obtained a court injunction against the demonstrators the day after the killing, without any notice to the natives, who were thus not present or even represented in court. But the police did not even wait for the court hearing before attacking the demonstrators the night before. Much, of course, is now being made of the injunction that was sought and obtained, and every police officer and every cabinet official that's testifying before the inquiry is saying the plan unfolded exactly as we intended. We applied for an injunction, we got an injunction, and we intended, always intended, for this to be resolved peacefully. The OPP refused to cooperate fully with the investigation conducted by the Ontario Special Investigation Unit, which is the civilian agency, as you know, that is mandated to investigate civilian deaths or serious injuries that are possibly result from police action. The SIU was unable to obtain any police testimony whatsoever regarding the beating of Cecil Bernard George to this day. A judge at a subsequent trial, in which Bernard George was charged with assault, accepted his version of the events as opposed to those of police officer after police officer, and he ruled that he had been holding a stick in legitimate self-defense against the police beating. 20 or so of the protesters who were charged with being in the park illegally were discharged because the Crown admitted that they were present in the burial ground with color of right. Ballistic tests disclosed the identity of the OPP sniper who had shot Dudley George in the chest, and he was subsequently convicted of criminal negligence causing death, but sentenced to 2 years less a day to be served in the community. Police sniper Sergeant Kenneth Dean was ruled by the judge to have concocted a story about Dudley and the other Indians being armed and having threatened or fired at the police. The judge ruled that the natives were unarmed and that Dean and other police witnesses had lied to cover up the fact that Dean had knowingly shot an unarmed man. Although Sergeant Dean was found to be criminally culpable in Dudley's death, he was given a conditional sentence, basically only requiring the service of 180 hours of community service. In its 1997 international report, Amnesty International stated that the killing of Dudley George took place in circumstances suggestive of an extrajudicial execution. Amnesty repeated its call for a full and impartial public inquiry into the event in 1997 and many years subsequently, including in a campaign that was launched and fortunately never needed to be completed on the 8th anniversary of the shooting of Dudley George. Finally, following Dudley's death, Premier Harris steadfastly claimed that he had received no memos, no briefing notes, or otherwise from the interministerial meetings held to discuss the Ipawash situation. He stated in the legislature, "I was involved in no meetings, I spoke to no one, there were no minutes, and there was nothing." However, documents and testimony from the Ipawash inquiry established that the Premier and other members of Cabinet were indeed involved in high-level Cabinet meetings in the hours before the shooting and made decisions or gave directions directly related to Ipawash protest and the police response, which ultimately led to Dudley's death. Although Premier Harris has claimed all along never to have been directly involved and never to have had any documentation, this latest information clearly shows him to have played a critical role of some influential kind. Almost 9 years after the shooting, as I've mentioned, and after years of calls by Ontario, national and international human rights organizations, the media, church groups, and the UN Human Rights Committee itself, the government of the new Liberal government of Ontario called a public inquiry into this shooting and into the events that surrounded it. And that inquiry began its work late in 2003 and its hearings in the spring of 2004. I have a few observations about this inquiry, which I make for myself. They're based on my experience as senior co-counsel to the Dudley George estate and the George family, and also as a Canadian citizen, but I do not make these remarks on behalf of my clients. The Ipawash inquiry is an impartial inquiry, but it's by no means the full inquiry called for by Amnesty International or the UN Human Rights Committee. First, the federal government, which, as you know, has overarching and exclusive constitutional jurisdiction for Indians and lands reserved for Indians, and whose policies, practices, and actions designed and directly brought about the total dispossession of the Chippewas of Stony Point, has refused point blank to attend or participate in this inquiry. This is as though the federal government refused to participate into an inquiry in the Mara Ra case. It is ultimately the commissions and omissions of the federal crown in pursuit of continuing policies of assimilation and dispossession that killed Dudley George. Whether or not a provincial premier became involved because some of the reserve that was taken from the Indians became provincial land and was violently cleared by a provincial police force, it's the federal government that is a root cause of this human rights situation, and the federal government is not participating and not attending this inquiry. Second, the Commissioner and Commission Council have, in my view, resisted and discouraged the George family and other Aboriginal parties from taking the Commission in the direction of a full and comprehensive discussion of the fundamental issues involved in this tragedy. For example, Aboriginal and treaty rights, the dispossession of Aboriginal peoples through the systematic taking of their lands and resources in Ontario and Canada right up to this day, the 10-year Ipawash cover-up at the level of three levels of government, and systemic racism, to name a few areas in which the Commission is extremely reluctant to go. This does not mean that these issues have not been raised by the George family and other Aboriginal parties, but it does mean that we, and as a result Canadians, and as a result the historical record of this event, cannot be confident that these fundamental human rights concerns will become part of the results and recommendations of this inquiry, rather than it just being concerned with better policing and better executive accountability. In the bigger picture, I have some wider observations about the broader human rights meaning of the Ipawash story. A public commission is meant to fulfill an important role in our society. It is not a trial, and it's not an election campaign. A public commission is meant to be a forum to examine in an open and comprehensive manner complex issues of public importance. Dudley George did not die with the following words on his lips: "There has to be a provincial public inquiry into better Aboriginal policing and the relationship between the executive of Queen's Park and the OPP in operational matters." He died saying, in Dudley's inimical way, "After 50 years of patient pleading, to no avail to have their 2,000-acre reserve restored to his people as promised. And I apologize again, but Dudley was a very colorful guy. Get the fuck off our land." Dudley George died because he was protesting the wrongful total dispossession of his people by the Canadian Crown, both federal and provincial. Dudley George died because when at OK in 1990 and Ipawash in 1995, and at Burnt Church in 2000, and at Naywash upon Georgian Bay through the 1990s, and on other occasions elsewhere, including the Red Hill Valley here in 2003, Canadian governments, police forces, the army, and even armed non-native mobs. Do not hesitate to use force or the threat of it to continue with the dispossession and to suppress native protest. These are human rights concerns, and they are human rights concerns that challenge all of us, for they go to the very heart of what kind of society Canada is and what kind of a country we as Canadians want. Aboriginal peoples in this country still live under colonial conditions, not mainly because they're disproportionately poor or lack essential services like clean drinking water that the rest of us take for granted, but because their human rights are not respected. And when this is systemically the case, it is inevitable that they're poor, and it is inevitable that they do not enjoy the services that the rest of us take for granted. Canada is a G8 country, as we know, with the wealth and means to be generous and honorable. Canada has the means to forge a just, respectful foundation for this country in its relationship with Aboriginal peoples, the first peoples of this land. Yet, for the most part, Canadian society and its leaders lack the necessary knowledge, the consciousness, and the understanding of the fundamental human rights issues that are at stake for Aboriginal peoples. Again and again, our leaders, and by extension we, fail to recognize that what is needed is a rights-based approach, rather than a handout-based approach, such as the one that we just witnessed at the First Minister's Conference in Kelowna. It is our continuing duty in what Professor Lorraine Weinrib at the University of Toronto Law Faculty refers to as this era of human rights, to pay heed to the rights, the aspirations, the needs, and the conditions of the most marginalized, oppressed, and dispossessed in Canada and internationally. Consciousness of human rights is, however, and this is the good news part of this story, and I sent the draft of my speech this afternoon to my daughter to comment on, and she wrote back and called me up and said, "Dad, what's the good news?" Well, the good news is that human rights are rather like a half-empty glass. And to focus for a second on the half of the glass that is full, as I said at the beginning of the speech, human rights are, as never before, universally known, universally stood, and universally claimed in the hearts and minds of ordinary people in every corner of this globe, no matter how dark and no matter how dispossessed the conditions in which they may find themselves. This represents a challenge, and I believe an inspiring opportunity for us all. Lessons of how we must pursue human rights can only be learned from the past, including how badly we got it wrong. In Canada, in such cases as Ipawash, where we pursued the suppression of a demonstration and the vanquishment of the special constitutional Aboriginal rights and claims of the people who lived there with lethal force. Such lessons are not easily learned, for they often present fundamental challenges to our governments and by extension to us all. The work of human rights is never ever done. As stated by Louise Arbour, who as you know, was formerly a Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada and is now the UN Human Rights Commissioner, human rights are our common heritage, and their realization depends on the contribution that each and every one of us is willing to make, individually and collectively, now and in the future. And I believe those are extremely wise words. Aldous Huxley once said, "Life must be lived forwards, but it can only be understood backwards." We must look back to our history, our past history, our ancient history, and our very recent history, to understand the many mistakes of the past, and especially to understand the foundations of our human rights instruments and values. Without such insight, we're doomed to repeat the mistakes of the past. Yet this inquiry into the past must always remain focused on the future and how we, individually and as a society, and in Canada as well as internationally, and contribute to the realization of the great promise of a world in which the rights of all are respected and upheld. I commend those of you who are here tonight who are part of the Amnesty International chapters and the other organizations that have sponsored this event for your quiet, your dogged, your determined, and your sometimes seemingly unrewarded work with on behalf of Amnesty International and the other organizations with which you're associated. Thank you again for this opportunity, and I wish you all the very best on 2005 Human Rights Day. Thanks very much.